listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie, and even though we've been doing this show for a while, I often think to myself, holy moly, we could not be more different. I'm a curmudgeonly cat lover, borderline antisocial, and scared to death when Amy says she has an idea, because that usually spells trouble.
You should never be afraid of my ideas, Carrie. I'm Amy. I want to be your new best friend, especially if you're a book lover, and maybe even if you aren't. I'm also a dog collector, a Diet Coke addict. I have an amazing banana bread recipe, you know, and I treat a good yard sale like it's a national treasure.
Despite these differences, we both love wine, cheese, and talking to each other, and sometimes a special guest about books. Each week we chat about what we're reading, as well as other bookish things like
authors in the news,
recent book-to-film adaptations,
weird stuff we've Googled while reading,
and our TBR count.
We're glad you've joined us. This week we learned that underwear is the great equalizer, Carrie, among all peoples.
That's right. So you're traveling this week. So we have reconnected with former guest Mick Sullivan, who is the curator of guest experience at the Fraser History Museum here in Louisville, Kentucky. And he's also the creator of the award-winning children's history podcast, The Past and the Curious, which grew out of the stories he tells people at the museum. His quirky combo of humor and music keeps both kids and adults interested and sneaks in a little history in the process.
The success of his podcast led to the publication of his first children's book, The Meat Shower, which is a fun telling of the historical event of meat falling from the sky in the 1800s. He has now published a book for older kids called I See Lincoln's Underpants, The Surprising Times Underwear and the People Wearing Them Made History.
This episode is a little something new and a little something old. In this combo episode, we chat with Mick to see what he's been up to since his last book was published. And you can also hear more about his first book when we discussed it with him in the early days of the show in episode 27.
It was a little cringy, Carrie, for me to go back and hear those episodes from the first season.
When we were really green.
But it's I think it's a fun combo to hear both of these. So we will be back with a new episode next week.
We are so glad to talk to Mick Sullivan. He's the guy who got us into this whole podcasting experience. You didn't know how fateful that cup of coffee was.
I had no idea. I'm glad it's gone this far. It's come full circle.
Well, it's been a minute since we've talked to you. The last time you were on the show, it was the before times. It was 2019, I think in the fall. And you had your book out, The Meat Shower. And now you have a new book out.
It's true. I do. I have a new book. It came out earlier this year. It's called I See Lincoln's Underpants, The Surprising Times Underwear and the People Wearing Them Made History. It's a different book than the other one. The first book was more of a picture book. This is, you know, kind of a chapter book. Each chapter is a biography of somebody, but it's aimed at younger readers, though everybody who reads it enjoys it. Just, you know, the big caveat is no matter who I'm talking about, be it George Washington or Queen Elizabeth or Annette Kellerman, who a lot of people have never heard of, their underwear is going to factor into the story somehow.
Okay, so a lot of times we ask authors, where did the inspiration for this come from? And I could not let this conversation go without asking.
I remember it very clearly, actually. I was in an airport waiting, you know, sitting at a table reading, and I was reading a book called The Great Bridge, which was about building the Brooklyn Bridge. I was coming back from New York. There was a letter that was reproduced because one of the guys, you know, the Roebling family did it, you know, but the son had been in the Civil War. And while he was, I think it was like 1863, so midway through the war, he was part of a regiment that Abraham Lincoln rode out to review the troops, and more or less everyone saw Abraham Lincoln's underwear, and it was very embarrassing for everybody, and everyone was startled that they were like the same homemade underwear that everyone else wore, and so like I just couldn't get past that. So I spent days thinking about it, and then I was like, oh, that's great, I need to do something with it. And then I, you know, through the years, find that I just worked to uncover stories, and I found other stories that kind of had underwear involved. And then it became clear that I needed to make a collection of them.
Well, you know, I was reading your book and you cover all kinds of people. You know, you have Lincoln, you also have Buzz Aldrin and how they go to the bathroom in space. And you right. have several members of royalty in there. You just have a wide swath of people. So I know you had a couple of stories that you found by chance, but to fill a whole book, did you have to Google famous people underwear?
Yes, that's
exactly what you did.
That's exactly what I did. There was definitely a point where I was hard up for material to fill it out and really had to get creative, really had to search high and low. Actually, what turned out being one of my favorite chapters is about the Mona Lisa. And I had written a story about that for the podcast that I have, The Past and the Curious, which is a children's podcast. And, you know, it was in my head that like, oh, I bet I can connect that. And I didn't. And then we did a Kickstarter to get the book off the ground, and the Kickstarter did so well that one of the like stretch goals was I'll write another chapter. So then I had to write very quickly another chapter that wound up being one of my favorites. And it's about how the man who stole the Mona Lisa in the early 1900s and thereby like making it super, super, super famous, he hid it in his tiny little apartment in Paris for years. And at some point it was in just a dirty old trunk with, you know, his clothes, like his underwear and socks, right? Like most famous painting in the world's like, you know, smelling this dude's stinky socks. And so I figured out ways to connect it. And that's the thing is like underwear isn't the crucial part of every story. Mm-hmm. Underwear is just in every story. Really, they're all really great stories about people. Like, it's a great way to learn about Annette Kellerman, who completely revolutionized swimming and women's swimwear, you know, at a time of women's dress reform. Or Satchel Paige, you know, people that, especially for young kids, like, these are stories that you should know and will appreciate because they're really great stories. And it's the underwear is just a lens to get you there, you know?
You work at the Fraser History Museum. Uh-huh. Here in Louisville. So your job is history, kind of like all day long. But you said the inspiration was this book you were reading about history. So do you tend to, whether it be for pleasure or for work, are you constantly sort of immersing yourself in history?
Yes, I am always, always, always poking around and seeing what turns up because it's what I do daily. I literally talk about history to the public, to kids every single day, you know, and there's also exhibit design that I'm a part of too. And I actually do all of our video production and, you know, it's been really great to kind of take media and put that as a new way to tell a story, right? Mm-hmm. Like I do it with podcasting on my side gig, but to do that as a job is really great. And it all works together because then, you know, I have these books and it's my goal to have more. You know, that's another part. And then, you know, the big part is I have this podcast that has grown far beyond my wildest dreams in terms of how far it's gone and how many people I've reached. And so I'm constantly writing like, and that's what's fun is the podcast to monthly release. So I am always researching and reading and writing. I mean, right now I'm reading about a guy from Hawaii who invented a particular type of, you know, guitar playing. And it's really cool because, you know, just in a very short span of time, I get to really immerse myself in something and see what I can connect it to that I already know.
When I was reading your book, I noticed that Chinook olives were in there. And that is something that Carrie remembers vividly from taking her kids to the Fraser Museum. It's a display that you did.
I wrote that panel like 8 years ago. It's like, this is going to be on the wall.
And it's in the book as well. Just explain what Chinook olives are.
It was from the Lewis and Clark expedition. And they had suffered tremendously getting through the Rocky Mountains because there was nothing to eat, especially at that time of the year. It was very cold. You know, and they thought about eating the horses that they had traded for. Luckily, they did not. But they make it out of the Rocky Mountains, just knocking on death's door. And they meet a group of natives who are known as the Nez Perce. And the Nez Perce offer them all sorts of food and you know, essentially nurse them back to health and take care of them. They wind up becoming really, really good friends with them. But one of the things that they eat are, the Chinook olives, which are
Really, not olives.
They're not olives at all. They're acorns, which your body can't digest. So they would dig a pit and they would collect all of the olives, and then everyone would just pee on them. And then the pee, the urine would break down, I guess the tannins or whatever, make it digestible. And then they would roast them. So they would roast, you know, it wasn't like, you know, they would burn the pee off.
Yeah. Yep. I love your stuff. And there's, I mean, I'm thinking of the meat shower, and with this, there's a little bit of a 9-year-old boy theme going through it. Mm-hmm. So do you think that you ever really outgrew that? No, I mean, adult women can enjoy it as well.
And
I'm just saying.
They do. Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. I mean, it's irreverent. I want to be able to laugh at stuff where it's appropriate. Obviously, when you're talking about history, there's plenty of things you can't laugh at and you shouldn't, you know, that's not funny. But to me, I guess with working with children, I recognized an ability to at least tell something to someone in a way that would make them receptive to it, make them smile, make them laugh. And when that's the case, the likelihood that you're going to remember that thing or it's going to stick with you, if you laughed when you heard it, is so much greater. So it's been really fun because I've been able to tap into that part of me. Like, it's who I am, you know?
Well, and me too, because I was 42, apparently, if you wrote that 8 years ago.
Yeah, and you remembered it. Right?
And I remember it. I mean, you know, and now not only do I remember that that was associated with Lewis and Clark, I also go, Mick Sullivan, it was associated. So I can't think about one without the other.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's awesome. That's really cool to hear.
Except for that you are always going to be associated with Chinook olives.
Take it. Take it.
So were there any chapters that when you were writing that were like the actual writing process of them was difficult for whatever reason, whether the tying in of the underwear or.
I questioned myself on a lot of them because I didn't know how strong the underwear tie might be, you know. Also, I questioned myself on this one, too, for a number of reasons. I did a chapter about Al Capone because I didn't really want to glorify in a kid's book like somebody terrible, but also it's an irreverent look at him and we can laugh at him in certain ways. And really the tie is that by the time he was sent to Alcatraz, he was put on laundry duty because, you know, he kept trying to show how powerful he was even within the walls of prison, which is how he wound up in Alcatraz. But he's on laundry duty, which meant, you know, he was washing everybody's undies, which, you know, is pretty, pretty big fall from grace, you know? So I that was the thing at the very end. And I was like, is that enough? It really doesn't matter. The chapter was fun enough and it fit what my listeners and readers have come to expect. So I was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. You know?
Right. Well, and there are two books, they're fictional, but Al Capone Does My Shirts.
Right.
The found fiction book. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, as soon as you said that, I was like, oh yeah, I knew that.
Right. Yeah. I think that's how I kind of stumbled on that and then read a few other books about it.
I want to ask you a question because not too terribly long ago, I was discussing history or nonfiction books with somebody. And so I'm reading a history book right now and it's interesting, but man, it is huge. This is about the Porter sisters. They were writers who came before Jane Austen and the Bronte sisters. But it is like a very, very thick book. I have to read it in very small chunks.
Yeah.
And what I was discussing with this person was about how I really sort of love history books that are not quite so big and scary. Because I'm interested in history, but I mean, if I remember two or three little snippets from this book, that's probably going to be the extent of it.
Right.
And so I'm wondering, as a person who enjoys reading history, what are your thoughts about making history, I don't want to say palatable, but our attention spans, I think, across the board have gotten a lot smaller. So
yeah,
what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been there. I know exactly what you're saying. Like, there's a difference between, you know, stuff that's more academic and like someone has really created like the definitive work on someone or something so that later on, you know, someone like me or anyone else can use that as a really great reference to build out something that's more accessible. I mean, if someone were able to tell a story from that book in 7 or 8 minutes, then the likelihood of that reaching more people is greater, right? That's my goal. Like, I'm not a historian in a, like, you know, a very definite sense. I consider myself, and I refer to myself as, a history advocate, just giving people an entryway into something. Like, these are the things that capture my imagination. These are the things that I'm excited about. These are the things that I think, you know, we stand to learn something from, or it's just good to know who this person is or how this thing came to be. And doing that in a short amount of time, obviously you can't build all of the context into it.
Right.
But the likelihood of reaching more people, and then some of those people retaining it or maybe wanting to dive deeper, is so much greater. And I think that there's a lot of value in that. Like, I could see how some people might look down their nose at it, but that's never... I don't even consider that, really. Trying to make things accessible for more and more people is always a good thing to me.
Yeah. Well, I've gotten to the point, and I know a lot of authors do this. They sort of make a young reader's edition.
Yeah.
Because, like, I want to read Braiding Sweetgrass. But again, that's a commitment. And so I just saw not too long ago that it has a young reader's edition. And I'm like, that's the one I'm reading.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, those are great.
Because really, it's like, I'm not going to retain a whole bunch, but I want to have the experience of learning and reading about it. Why can't I read those and get a little bit of information?
No, I know exactly what you're saying. You can kind of skim to find the things that are going to resonate with you and probably still have, maybe in the end, like, a better experience from the book as well.
So is there anything new with your wildly successful children's podcast? Is there anything going on with that we need to update people about?
I was invited this year to travel up to Boston for WBUR's Children's Podcast Festival.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They flew me up there, put me up in the hotel. And I mean, I was flabbergasted because I was there with, like, shows that were on networks like American Public Radio and NPR. And wow. I'm just like a dude who makes a show in my basement, you know. I was one of six performers. So I went on Sunday right before Smash Boom Best, which is an APR show. It's awesome. And Press from Boston University. And they had to turn over the theater. So people would wait outside until the show ahead of you finished. And so I was, like, tabled right by a window. And Molly Bloom from Smash Boom Best, like, taps me on the shoulder and says, "Look out the window. Look at your audience." And there was a line going all the way down the building. Like,
oh my God.
I mean, 150 people came to see this. So I gave her my phone and I was like, "Film this." And I just ran outside and just gave everybody a high five in the line. And it was awesome. I mean, like, it was really beyond belief. I could not believe that I was, you know, on a stage on a Sunday afternoon in Boston, and there were between 150 and 200 people there who came to see me and were there because they connected with the show so much. Like, it was absolutely astounding. I mean, at the end, I was literally moved to tears. Like, it was so amazing. Yeah. And it was fun. I mean, it was a blast. I sang songs and told stories that they knew and they didn't know. And I could not believe that it really happened, you know?
That's amazing. So, okay, how many years have you been doing the show now?
I launched it in October of 2016.
Wow.
Okay. You've been doing it a while and you're still going strong. You haven't tired of it yet.
I haven't. Like, I'm pretty gung-ho. I still enjoy it. I only release monthly. So that's the thing. People always say, like, "I wish you released more." And it's like, well, I need to figure out a way to do that because I have other things going on in my life. Right. And it's not financially going to replace that. So,
well, congratulations. It's been great catching up with you and finding out what's been going on in the life of Mick Sullivan in the past and the curious. And you'll get to hear the first interview that we did with Mick way back in 2019. Thanks for joining us, Mick.
Thanks for having me. It was great to talk to you all again.
Amy and I are in the studio today with Mick Sullivan, a historical educator at the Fraser Museum in downtown Louisville, Kentucky. We met Mick kind of accidentally. He had given a talk at the Louisville Free Public Library's How To Festival about podcasting. And so we just reached out, and he was so helpful to us when we started this adventure or misadventure, whatever you want to call it. So we invited him to the studio to talk about the stories that he tells on his podcast, The Past and the Curious. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here. And congrats on getting it off the ground.
Woohoo!
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I do work at the Fraser History Museum. I'm the manager of youth and family programs, which is a fancy, I'm a history advocate, I guess, you know, I work with kids. I do all of our summer camp programming and that sort of stuff. But I also have for 3 years now, I just realized it's been 3 years, I've had a podcast called The Past and the Curious, which is a family focused podcast that does history and music in an offbeat sort of way. And it's been extremely rewarding and super, super fun to put together.
So you're also a musician, too.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I am. I am also a musician. I play banjo and mandolin. And
I know that your podcast has gotten some awards lately.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure.
Brag on yourself right, a little bit.
Pat yourself on the back.
The first one that I got, which was totally weird and out of left field, was The Times of London, named The Past and the Curious, one of the top 10 children's podcasts of, that was 2017, which was really early going on. But just recently, I was featured for the second time on a list put out by Common Sense Media, which is, as far as adjudicating things for parents to consume for children, it's the best. I mean, it really, really matters because people have pulled from that list. It just got republished on the Washington Post. So like that was a big deal.
So tell us a little bit, what is The Past and the Curious? Tell us a little bit about what your podcast is about.
Yeah, it's kind of a variety show almost, you know, they're usually 25 to 30 minutes long. And each episode is themed. So there'll be like the one that I'm working on right now, the theme is polymaths. So it's two stories of two people. It's a story of two people who were really, really good at lots of different things. And so the first story, we tell the story. It's have a guest reader. There's music backing and stuff that I create. And then we do a quiz time section and then tell the second story. And so we kind of leave it up to the listeners to relate the two in their brain. And there's always connections to make. And then there's often a piece of music at the end that I create and perform.
Were you a history major?
No, I was a music major.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was a music major at Bellarmine University.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Bellarmine, woo!
Yeah, go Knights.
So how did your love of history come about?
I don't know. I think about that all the time. My grandfather was really into it and would take me places. So I guess, you know, like, on that level, that's where it began. But I was working in the family business a decade ago and had this bubbling of like energy of curiosity and had read some books that really grabbed me. And then my wife and I went on this crazy epic vacation where we went to Charlottesville and then to Virginia coast and then went up the peninsula and to Philadelphia and Gettysburg and stuff and came back and was just like infatuated and just couldn't stop reading and or doing anything related to history. So that's like when it really took root, I guess, but it definitely goes back to my childhood.
Well, then what was the impetus to doing the podcast, a history podcast for kids?
Because I deal with kids professionally and teach history to kids. When you're looking them in the face and trying to keep their attention, you really have to work. And so I was always looking for something, a creative way to tell stories. And I would, I think, probably overdo it because, like, I would just get so into it that it would take so much time to put together a story. And then I would tell it once to these kids, and that was it. So I wanted it to kind of live on longer than that.
You wanted it to last longer.
That's the way I feel about making dinner.
Yeah, totally.
You put a lot of work into it, and it's gone in, like, 7 minutes. So right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's about how long my stories are, too. So I think that was the main thing, was I just wanted – I knew that other kids could use this, and I enjoyed it, and I wanted to develop it further. And you know, as a musician, I had some audio skills, but wanted to develop those further, too. So it just kind of seemed like a good marriage.
Your format is really interesting. I've listened to several episodes of it, and it's a really fun listen. Even though it's, I think, focused more towards kids, would you say like 8 to 12?
Yeah. That's the sweet spot. I'm surprised. I do have a lot of parents say that there are younger kids that listen, which is great. I think that's awesome. And I think when kids are listening, they can listen at a higher level than they can read.
Also great for adults, though. I enjoyed listening to it as an adult.
That's the best feedback that I get, is that parents will say, my kid loves this podcast, my kid loves this podcast, our family loves your podcast.
Awesome. Yeah, it's definitely something you could listen in the car with your kids and both of you get something out of it. But I think it's interesting with the quiz section, and you intersperse some music in there. Do you do all the music that's...
Yeah, for the most part. Sometimes I'll have, you know, like I'll have a friend who's got something that's a perfect fit anyway, so I'll plug that in and credit them. But for the most part, yeah, I mean, 95% of the music on the show I'll create.
Because the music is sort of related to whatever topic that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. How did you come up with the whole concept of how you wanted it to be, how you wanted the structure of it to be?
I messed with the first episode. I prototyped the first episode for 5 or 6 months and was just trying to figure out a way to play to my strengths. And also, you know, based on my knowledge of working with kids up to that point, like what would hold attention, you know, what was a good target length for most things. Also thinking, like, if you're going to listen to it in the car, like, can you break it up? Like, I didn't want it to be one long story for multiple reasons. Kids would lose interest and it might not fit your transportation time to school, you know? So, I mean, yeah, those are all considerations.
He put a lot more thought into what he's doing than what we're doing here. I can tell you that.
I mean, it was still a shot in the dark.
What makes a story one you want to feature on your podcast? Are there certain elements that you're looking for?
If there's a way that I can make it funny, then that's going to be a big one. If it's going to fit into that theme that I've got for a show, then that's great idea too. I think more than anything, like if it captures just a part of my imagination, then I'm pretty sure it will with a kid too. One of the stories that I'm planning for October is about this automaton that this member of Prussian nobility made, and it was a chess playing automaton, and he made it to impress the queen, who was Marie Antoinette's mom. So Maria Theresa, I guess. And so he wanted to like win her favor. So he made this machine and he would take it around and beat Napoleon and it beat Ben Franklin and like did all the stuff. And it was crazy. And it was a scam. Like there's a person inside of it. You know? But it was like, how can I not tell this story? Right. And so that one is going to work out really easily because my friend Heather Gottlieb, who has written a couple stories for the show as well, who I work with at the Fraser, she's got this great story that she always tells of how Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. And it's a perfect kind of thing. Like those are going to match really well.
And great you got,
like,
for this, October.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Well, all of that too.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. So that's a great example of a story that'll do that. But I get a lot of comments about how the stories are diverse. Ish, like the next episode, both stories are people of color. And then there's all sorts of really great stories of women that never get told as well. So anytime I can find a story like that, it's going to find its way onto the show. Somehow.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. Cause there's lots of untold history of,
absolutely.
Of women, minorities that are important that don't get told
a
lot.
Absolutely.
I'm curious about this. So are some of the stories kind of like, I keep thinking more, not like Ripley's, but sort of far out there. Does that seem to draw you?
Yeah, I'm definitely drawn to that sort of stuff. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
If there were Ripley's, believe it or not, for history.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I mean, the first episode that I did was P.T. Barnum. To me, he was a despicable person, but he was also like one of the most fascinating people in history. And there's something to be said about, you know, just making a show, you know? Yeah,
I mean, it's got to entertain you, or you're not going to want to.
Exactly,
listen.
Exactly. Right. I do like big things.
Is there a key to making history interesting for kids?
I think being excited about it is the most important thing. That's it. Like if you're excited about something, kids are going to pick up on that.
So modeling, the behavior that you want from them.
Well, and I do think the humor is such a big part. I think sometimes education has gotten really good at taking the fun out of learning.
Absolutely.
And so I feel like if kids are having fun, they're going to pick up a lot of stuff, and you can kind of sneak education in there if they're having a good time.
Yeah.
So I think that's important.
And I got that from working in the summer camp program at the Fraser. That's how we structure everything. And we call it stealth learning. It's like everybody's having fun. Everybody's laughing. And then the kids go home and they start talking to their parents. And their parents are like, what are you talking? I can't believe you're telling me about form over function. Yeah. Like, how do you know about that? And they're like, I don't know. I just learned about right. it today. It was fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the music that you use on your podcast, how do you create it? Is it electronic? I don't know. I don't know enough about music to even be able to ask a question intelligently, I think. But how do you make the music?
Well, it's a mixture of both. Practical and digital, I guess, if it was special effects. So I work in the same program that you all work in, actually. And once the stories are edited, I'll put music behind that. And sometimes I'll use just a digital keyboard and the sound samples that the program has. But oftentimes I'll mix that with acoustic instruments like mandolin or guitar or banjo. Now, when I do a song at the end, that's always live instruments and stuff that I'll just overdub.
Are a lot of your stories about Kentucky for the podcast?
I sneak quite a few of them in there.
Okay.
But if I do, I try to make them have importance far beyond the border. Enid Yandell wound up in there, and I just think she's super interesting. People should know about her. Oh, the Marquis de Lafayette story, I actually tell the story of his approach. He was on the Grand Tour in 1824. He was the only survivor, and James Monroe brought him back to go on tour and like rally people because America was needed him. And his steamboat crashed right outside of Louisville, and they had to go rescue him in the middle of the night. So that's the story that I tell. But obviously, it's like more about Marquis de Lafayette. So if I can sneak Louisville in there and Kentucky in general, yes, I will. It's important to me.
So I want to ask you, recently, in addition to the podcast, you have also published a book. So yes. Tell us a little bit about that book that I actually have somewhere over here.
It's over there. I see
it. It's over there. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. It took a long time to get together, but it is about the historic event that really happened in 1876 in Bath County, Kentucky, that is known as the Kentucky Meat Shower. So the book is called The Meat Shower because I didn't want to, you know, make people think that it was just for Kentucky people. It's an international book, I promise. But yeah, what's the tagline? I forget.
The mostly true tale of an odd and somewhat edible occurrence.
That's it. Yeah.
With this book, how did this come about? I mean, had you told the story on the podcast and then?
I had not. I was waiting. And so I released an episode about that when the book came out. So that was all done on purpose. Did you get that from the library?
Yes. I did.
Oh, sweet. Which library has it?
Let's see. The free public.
There was a waiting list for it when I requested it.
Hot diggity dog. <Yeah, I know. laughs>
But I go to the Northeast, so that's where it came I don't know where it came from.
Cool, that's awesome. That's exciting.
So tell us about the meat shower.
Yeah, so how you got to the point where you decided this is what...
Yeah.
So, so flabbergasted by that it was at the branches.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, part of the podcast idea was I want to publish books, and no one was going to take me seriously because I had no audience at all. I was just some dude in Kentucky, and there's plenty of dudes everywhere. So I thought, you know, if I can create something and a following, hopefully someone will take me seriously and help me put out a book. And it worked, and I hope it'll work again more and better. But yeah, it's a story that I loved. It actually, my friend John, his birthday is March 3rd. And so just one night we were meeting, and he was like, check out this weird thing that happened on my birthday. And, you know, for a couple years, we would just joke about the Kentucky Meat Shower. And slowly the story formed in my idea. And for some reason, I decided to make the chunk of meat the narrator of the story. And I thought, you know what? Like, that's my end. Like, that's how I'm actually going to get somebody to bite on this crazy story. Because just telling it's not... I mean, you can go on the internet and find any number of reasonably decent tellings of the story on whatever websites. But, you know, there's one surviving specimen of meat in the world.
I found that
crazy.
I know. I really feel like I need to go. I was like, oh my gosh, it's because I didn't know that even existed. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I need to now go to Transylvania to go see this. Transylvania University.
When we did the book launch, we did it at the Fraser in the gift shop, and they brought the chunk of meat up.
Oh, that's great. Yes. I can't believe we missed a chunk of meat.
So we didn't actually say what, I mean, we called it a meat shower, but can you give just a like a brief little thing about what that is?
Yeah. So it was 1876 and it was in Bath County, Kentucky, which I mean, it's not far from Lexington. And it was on one particular farm, the Crouch Farm, and middle of the day, for no reason, chunks of meat start falling from the sky and they cover, some say flakes, you know, most of the reports say flakes of meat, but they also then say like some of them were like 1 and 1.5 inches. I was like, well, that's a chunk.
Yeah. You know?
And the piece that we had was definitely a chunk. It started falling and covered about, you know, like a football field's worth of space. And everybody kind of lost their minds. Like, what's going on?
Well, understandably.
And what was amazing and why I think it was worth a children's book is that there's no explanation. Like there's no one has ever come up with. It's never been solved. You know, in the 1800s, like there are all sorts of mysteries that permeated the world and like eventually science explained them, but science never really got around to this one. And so, you know, 150 years later or whatever, we can still be like,
oh. Which is really crazy if you consider they still have one sample of the meat. You'd think they would be able to
like test it. Maybe it's just not a high enough priority.
Well, actually, we almost didn't get it because it was in London being gene sequenced.
Oh, really?
But it's been in this like weird formaldehyde. Oh, for like, so, you know, whatever. If they got results, they have been very tight-lipped about it.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any.
Well, I was reading this last night, and I have to say, there were a number of things I liked about it, but I was especially impressed. You had some alliteration going on here.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
So, I mean, when you found a publisher, did they want to tweak things, or was it they were on board with what you had?
They were on board. This didn't work in the traditional publishing format. Like, I didn't have an agent. It's a small press. It's actually a local press. And they were sold on the idea and the fact that I had an illustrator almost done and everything.
So you found your own illustrator.
Yeah. And yes. And I know someone who works at Hatchet Books in Boston, like a friend from college, whatever. And so he introduced me to some people and they were like, oh, no, don't do that. Don't do any of that. If I don't, it's not going to happen. So so I'm going to go ahead and do it. You know, because I think if it were some major publisher were to pick up a book, then it would the agent or the editor somewhere, someone way above me would make all of those decisions.
Right.
Which if that happens for me later on, great. But that wasn't going to happen in this case for this book. But I wanted the book to be out. So,
well, I'm impressed.
Worked with a great illustrator.
I was like, oh, wow, we got some good stuff going on in here.
Yeah.
But the other thing I especially liked was the. I won't say what happened, but it involves vultures. And oh, I just thought this was great.
You can talk about that all you want. That
barfing vultures.
Yeah, there's a 2-page spread of vultures vomiting. And that image was in my head forever. And I was like, that's the selling point of the book. Like, because I know some kid's going to turn the page and just lose it.
Right. And some 46-year-old women, too.
Yeah. Yeah. That page was gave me enough motivation
for
to finish the
book.
Yeah. Like I know this is like the payoff right here.
Yeah. That was great. Yeah. Have you been able, and maybe this interferes with your full-time job, but have you been able to go to like schools or would you be able to go to schools if that became a possibility or has that been?
We've had a couple inquiries and we're working on it. Yeah. Okay. It's just scheduling. Like I have to do that, you know, obviously work around the day job.
Right. Right.
But yeah, that's super exciting. And the illustrator lives in Louisville too. And his girlfriend is a teacher. So she's had a lot of people approach her. So yeah, I mean, there's been hopefully more and more of that will happen.
That's very cool.
Well, it seems like with the popularity of your podcast, and now that you have a book that's, you know, in the same vein of the kind of things that you do on your podcast, that you could have a whole series. Are you planning on more? And do you have ideas swimming around in your head?
I do. There are a couple stories from the podcast that I think would make incredible books. And I hope to do something like that picture book wise. But, you know, people are weird about picture books. I think everyone just automatically assumes they're for young kids. And like at one of the reading, one of the kids was like, oh, my mom says that's below my reading level. And I was like, but it's awesome.
Yeah. And it's history.
It's hilarious.
I mean, whatever.
So there's that. I'm actually in the middle of working on something that I think will be a really good fit. Fingers crossed that I can do something with it. But I'm trying to create, have you ever seen those books, How They Croaked, How They Choked?
Yes. Yeah.
There's another one that's, it's a different author that's about.
So it's for a little bit older reader.
Yeah.
But like, it still has that, it has visuals, it has pictures and stuff like that.
So when I write a story for the podcast, it's usually 1,200 to 1,600 words. And I was reading through these, I was counting words. I was like, oh, these are exactly the same length as my podcast. So I'm trying to adapt a couple stories from the podcast and also have a whole other set of stories that I haven't done audio treatment yet and probably won't. So I want to create this reader for fourth to sixth grades. And it's about famous people or historical people and their underwear. I'm like, how? It seems like a winner to me, you know? How could it not?
Sold. Yeah. Oh, that's fantastic. You know, I will say this. So I have read some big history books, Doris
Kearns Goodwin.
Yeah. And I mean, and it was great. But the truth of the matter is, honestly, I'll probably remember more about the meat shower book than I will about the Lincoln book.
Right.
Because there was so much information packed in that. Yeah. And you just can't retain all of that.
Right.
You know, what it was, a team of rivals. So I don't know. I really feel like we need to, in general, and I'm bad at this too, sometimes myself with that mom thing, you know, like, well, that's sort of below what you should be reading. But it's like, if you get some good information from it, whether it's a cereal box or whether it's a 900 page tome, it's got value.
Yeah. You know? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's something I try to keep in mind when I'm writing stories for the podcast too, because I did a story about Lincoln and I'm not going to tell the enormity of Lincoln's life. You know, you can't. So I'll tell one story that's funny that I know that kids will remember and then fill in some details around it for context just to help flesh it out. And I think that even that tangential stuff will stick in a kid's brain more than, just reading whatever assignment they were given, you know.
Or even a graphic novel.
Yeah.
Would be kind of a fun way to go too.
Yeah.
It seems like we talk about graphic novels a lot.
But I know, but they are making such an impact for kids. I think we're kind of getting to a point where they're becoming increasingly popular. And and the truth is, kids now are so used to having information in smaller chunks because of social media.
Yeah.
And because so much is flying at them all the time, I substitute teach. And kids, if they have a 2-page story, they're like, oh, it's so long, you know? And I'm looking at it, I'm like, no, not really that long. But from their perspective and what they're used to getting, that is, it can feel overwhelming. So,
I totally get that. And I mean, with that in mind, then all the stuff that I'm working on is probably too long. And that's why I probably won't be able to sell it to a publisher, because they'll be like, no, it's not marketable. You need to chunk it out. You need to think like a graphic designer instead of a writer.
So when you decided to pick The Meat Shower, I mean, were you intentionally trying to do a Kentucky story, or was it just that the story happened to be in Kentucky? You just thought it was a great story.
I thought it was just a great story. I thought it was super fun. But I also recognized the fact that I have Kentucky connections. So if it couldn't happen in a traditional format, like with a publisher, with a major publisher, I might be able to make it work through local channels, which I did. So, but it was a great story. I think anyone anywhere would like it.
Right.
It's not Kentucky specific.
Do you see yourself doing more Kentucky, like intentionally trying to find more Kentucky stories, or not necessarily pigeonholing yourself into just Kentucky stories?
I love Kentucky stories. So in a perfect world, I would do both. I would have the underwear book available, but then also I've been working with another artist to create just like a little zine that I'm going to give to my Patreon sponsors. And she does these really cool, it's like pencil and gouache. So it almost looks, you know, I'm not an artist. When she said gouache, I was like, I don't know
what that is.
It kind of looks like whiteout, you know, like, it's on like cardboard, and she does pencil and gouache and then like a little bit of colored construction paper accent. And so she's been doing these drawings of stories from the podcast. And so we're going to print a little zine with a picture and then like a condensed version of the story, like it chunked out 200 words, and do that. And one of the reasons I want to try it is to see how effective it is and how quickly we can do it. Cause I have a bunch of stories about Louisville specifically that I think need to get told, and no one's telling them, or if they are, they're one of the things with history is people just make it so inaccessible. It's like, oh yeah, we talk about that stuff all the time. It's like, well, you talk about it way up here or to each other and not to the general public,
right,
or to kids and get them excited about things. So it's something I want to try.
I didn't know that this was a story about Kentucky, but Floyd Collins and the caves. Have you heard of that story?
I know the name.
Okay.
No, tell me.
So, well, Floyd Collins, he was trapped in a cave in Kentucky, and it was the first time that the cave system in Kentucky had gotten like vast media attention. And so him getting trapped, and ultimately he died in the cave, but led to Kentucky being known for its cave systems. And so I didn't hear the story until I was in college at Bellarmine, mm-hmm, heard about him. So now I teach a book. It's a, I guess for middle schoolers, it's called Bell Prater's Boy. And it mentions Floyd Collins. And I get to tell my students about it. So anyway, maybe you want to do that one.
Yeah.
Because it's super interesting.
Totally. Absolutely.
And not very, I mean, like I said, I didn't know about it. And, you know, not many people know that story. But it was, I mean, it was like a big sensationalized story. There were, you know, news media and writers from major newspapers coming into Kentucky.
Was it in part of Mammoth Cave?
Yeah, in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure I've gotten some of the details wrong, but it was this big thing. He got trapped and he was in there for, I don't know how many days exactly. But
ultimately to a bad end.
Yes.
Poor Floyd.
Poor Floyd. But anyway, I think there was like a play, like a Broadway play about Floyd Collins. So there you go. You can add it to your list.
So I have one more question about your podcast. Well, when I first started listening to podcasts, I don't think I realized how much time it takes. But how much time does it take you to write the stories that you tell, make the music, the whole shebang?
It's hard to like calculate all of the hours because I just do things in the cracks of the day. You know, I have two kids, little ones, but I release monthly. Like I can only do that, to the chagrin of some of my listeners. They're like, why don't you make more? Sorry. But that seems to be a pretty good schedule. So I usually will do the writing up front, and that depends, you know, there's a lot of research involved, and I write in the morning. So, you know, I don't know, say 8 hours for that content to generate. And then the recording is super fast. Like I can, since it's all scripted, like I have somebody read it, I'll invite somebody over and say, plan to do, it'll take you 30 minutes. Like if that's it. But the editing usually takes another couple hours, music another couple hours. So, you know, I don't know, 20 hours of time, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's way more involved than what I think people, well, I know certainly what we thought, just, you know, scheduling and recording. And there's a lot of sort of minutiae that you don't realize are part of a podcast.
Yes, totally. Totally. Yeah. And then all the back end stuff, like getting everything uploaded and
all, figuring whatever, out what you're going to title stuff.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
These little tiny things that they aren't even on your radar when you start doing this.
Absolutely.
So,
Yeah. That stuff's the part that wears me down. Me an intern.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and talking about your book. We are going to take a break. And when we come back, we are all going to talk about what we're reading right now.
We're back in the studio with Carrie and Mick, and we're going to all talk about what we're reading. So, Carrie, what is that book that you're holding?
Okay, so this is American Born Chinese, and I'm sure I'm going to mess the author's name up. Jean Luen Yang is the author, and this is fantastic. I really enjoyed this book. I finished it in a day. It is a graphic novel, and it's actually sort of three stories. The first is about the Monkey King. And it tells about how the Monkey King got his power and ultimately why he ends up under a mountain of rocks. So that's the first section. And then that story is interspersed with the story of Danny, who's a Caucasian boy who has a cousin named Chin Ki, who comes and stays with him. And Chin Ki is sort of that stereotypical idea of what a Chinese person is. Like if you think about what's the movie Christmas Story, the guys at the Chinese restaurant singing fa ra 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 ra.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's a portion of this book, it tells the story of Danny and his cousin Chin Ki, who comes and visits him like once a year and completely embarrasses him. And then the other story is of a boy. He moves to the United States. Well, I guess he doesn't move. His parents had come to the United States, and then he moves and starts a new school, and it's about how he makes friends. So you're reading this, and there are these three separate stories that you think have nothing to do with each other, and you're struggling to try to figure out, okay, what's going on? Who's this white kid, Danny? What is going on? Well, by the end of the book, the author weaves all three stories together, and it is just so meaningful and powerful. So it's a story for a person who is a minority. They can definitely take something from this about being true to who they are and not allowing other people to make them feel less than great. But even if you're not a minority, you can read this about being your true self and making sure that you don't try to change to make other people happy. It was just wonderful. My middle son, you know, so he's on the big graphic novel kick, and he read it and he was just raving about it to me. So again, I'm like, if a sixth grade boy is raving about a book, it must be pretty good. So I read it. He and I were actually waiting at an appointment on Saturday, and he kept leaning over as I was reading it. He was like, oh, that's a really good part. Oh, that's a really good part. So, and then making comments. And then we ended up talking about some of the things that I felt like he maybe didn't entirely get. You know, like he got it on one level, but maybe not on another level. So we ended up talking about that. So I highly recommend it.
And I feel like anytime your kid wants you to read the book that they just read so that they can talk to you about it, that's a win right there.
That's big.
And it helps get the books I've read for this year. I mean, I'm edging close to 70 books. That's one of the nice things about graphic novels, you know, as an adult. You can get through them pretty quickly. So, Mick, tell us about what you're reading.
I'm in the middle right now of Spying on the South, which is the book that Tony Horowitz published just before his untimely passing. And I'm a huge fan of Tony Horowitz. Confederates in the Attic was a really important book to me. And
I'm not familiar with him. So does he write nonfiction or fiction?
It's nonfiction. Okay. He was actually a correspondent during the first Iraq War, and then came back to America and started writing about history. But he has this, almost all of his books, he did a book about John Brown that's like very history based. But the rest of his books, this one included, he follows a person, a storyline or something. It's almost like a Gonzo sort of thing, because he goes to the places. So in this book, Frederick Law Olmsted, who is an important person for a number of reasons, but to us in Louisville, for sure, for our park system.
And for many park systems around the country.
Oh, yeah, of course. Right. Yeah, Boston and, yeah, Buffalo and New York City. But before the war, right before the Civil War, he was hired by the New York Times to travel around the South and write sort of like as a spy, like dispatch, you know, because it was a fractious time and they knew things were coming to a head, but they were trying to get a clear picture and just see what a casual observer would see down there. So he traveled from West Virginia to Kentucky to Tennessee to Alabama, all the way across Texas. I think he winds up doing two circuits and writing. And his perspective changes because at first, you know, he has thoughts about slavery, obviously not favorable, but then like by the end of it, like he's absolutely staunch abolitionist. So what Tony does is he actually follows the exact same path and looks at the world through our modern fractured society, because that's what we're looking at, you know. And Tony, his way that he would do it is like he would, one of the scenes, he's actually coming down the Ohio River on a coal barge with coal barge workers. Whatever town he's in, he goes to the bar and bellies up and talks to people and winds up going to some really interesting places, seeing crazy things. Yeah. So it's a really, really interesting today and back then sort of telling of different sides of America. It's a really fascinating book.
So it sounds like it would be
a pretty easy read, maybe for somebody who doesn't want to read like a really heady.
Oh no, it is the easiest. Yeah, absolutely. It is super, super easy. And it's a lot like his book, Confederates in the Attic, which was what really vaulted him to like a certain status.
Is that the one that you said meant a lot to you?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
What's that one?
He and his wife is an Australian novelist, Geraldine Brooks, I want to say. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner. So is he.
Oh, okay.
Like they're a power couple, you know?
Yeah.
And so in that book, they had just moved to Virginia. And like he wakes up one day and there's a reenactment going on, basically on his front yard or so it seems, as he tells it. And he goes and meets one of the guys, and they talk him into like going out on the road, like doing a couple of the reenactments with him or whatever. So he does that. So the rest of it is him traveling across Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, Alabama, all these places, and talking to people and trying to understand where this lost cause mythology comes from and why people are holding on to it. And the people that he interacts with are like Japanese tourists who are going to a Scarlett O'Hara impersonation, you know, these crazy scenes that he just has a way of like getting into. And you're there with him. He puts you there. And he's like who I want to be if I was more socially outgoing. Like you get me in a room with like people that I'm comfortable with, I can talk, but like I'm not gonna like put myself in those situations. I mean, he did, like that's what he did. All of his books are that way, and they're really, really great. But he's always looking for answers to important things that have shaped America.
That's now I definitely want to read one.
I know. Definitely. Well, Amy, what have you been up to?
Well, I'm gonna do a throwback because I'm kind of between books. So I thought I'd talk about one that is one of my all-time favorites that I still think about today. And it's a book called Life of Pi by Jan Martel. Maybe many of our readers have read it, but if not, it's one I think you definitely should pick up. It was published in 2001 and it won the Booker Prize. Pi is the name of the main character, and he's a young Indian man, and his parents run a zoo in India, and this is in the 1970s. And they decide to close that zoo, and they have sold the animals off to various zoos in North America. So he and his family and all the zoo animals board a Japanese freighter headed towards the United States and Canada. There's a big storm at sea, and that ship sinks. And he makes it onto a lifeboat along with a hyena, a zebra, an orangutan named Orange Juice, and a tiger that has the human name Richard Parker. So they are afloat on the sea for 227 days. And much of the book is about how they, you know, stay alive or don't stay alive, depending on which character it is. And the power struggle between Pi and Richard Parker. And eventually they wash up on the shore of Mexico. And the Japanese ministry comes to interview him about what happened on this trip. And they question him. The investigators feel like things might not be exactly as they seem. And I don't want to give anything away with the book, but when I read this book, it kind of blew my mind. There's, you know, a couple of books that I have read, and this is one of those, but I think that this one has a lot of philosophical questions in it as well. And it's just a book that I still think about. I never did see the movie. I was afraid that the movie wouldn't stand up to my...
It doesn't.
Okay, good. Then I won't see
I did
it.
See the movie. It's not terrible, but the book, I had the same reaction when I read the book. Like, mind blown. There's a certain part at the end of that book where just, you question your whole existence, I feel like. You don't get that same sense in the movie.
No. Okay, well, good. Then I don't feel bad that I never saw that movie.
Now, maybe if you see that movie and you have not read the book, maybe you do. But if you have read the book and then you see the movie, it just doesn't.
I don't think that they could translate it, probably. But, you know, it's lost. If the volleyball that Tom Hanks had was really a tiger that could eat you. But anyway, I highly recommend that book. So there it is for my throwback that a favorite.
Sounds like we've got some good books that maybe people need to put on their TBR lists.
Well, Mick, tell our listeners where they can find your podcast and where they can find you on social media if you are on it.
Yes. Yeah. On any podcatcher, I should be there. So I'm on iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and all those. The Past and the Curious. So I have the website, thepastandthecurious.com. And the book is available at earlyworkspress.com/shop. There's also a link from my website to that. And I'm on all social media too, as at Past and Curious, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook.
All right.
For show notes for any episode, go to our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabooklover pod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover.
If you like what we're doing with the show, tell a friend. Word of mouth is one of the best ways to help people find us, or leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there live or in archives at forwardradio.org.